We have one capital case this afternoon. You're familiar with our lighting system. When the yellow light goes on, that means your time is drawing to a close, so you can start to wrap up. If we take you beyond the red light, then don't worry about it. You're on our time and not yours. And with that, let me go ahead and call the case. Number 21-11591, Brandy Bain Jennings versus the Secretary of the Florida Department of Corrections. Mr. Khalil.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Excuse me. My name is Paul Callow. I represent Mr. Jennings in this appeal of the denial of habeas corpus relief. Trial counsel testified at the post-conviction evidentiary hearing that if Brandy Jennings had one thing, it was a mother and a good one. I submit that no reasonable jurist could say that counsel performed an investigation of any reasonable degree and then came to the conclusion that Mrs. Jennings was a good mother. The post-conviction testimony demonstrates that she was mentally ill herself. She had drug problems. She was not a caring mother. She was possessive. She was neglectful of Mr. Jennings. She didn't provide food. She didn't provide consistent housing. She was sexually promiscuous, if I may use that judgmental term, but and Mr. Jennings was exposed to all of that. In addition, she was exposing Mr. Jennings to people that she knew to be child molesters. To the extent that Mr. Jennings moved—
There's no evidence that he was sexually assaulted, correct?
I wouldn't agree with that, in that he was exploited by an older woman when he was 12 years old. I believe it was 12 years old.
When you refer to he was exposed to child molesters, both of those were men, and there's no indication that he was sexually abused by either of the men to whom you're referring, correct?
Honestly, no. But there is testimony that his uncle, who was a known child molester, would pay Mr. Jennings money to sit on his lap, and Mr. Jennings often did that. It was testified to by Dr. Sultan in post-conviction, and that was a big red flag for her, in that that's not a very normal behavior, and especially when mom knows that this person is a child molester, you know, why would she allow that?
Here's a question I have for you that's kind of a practical question. So you've got the evidence of that. You've got the sort of the statutory rape when he was 12 years old. How would one go about, if one were representing him at trial, how would one go about getting that evidence in at the penalty phase? Who would testify to that?
A number of people could testify. Number one would be a competent mitigation specialist. And that would be someone with training and experience in investigating and developing mitigation. Now, in post-conviction, we had Dr. Sultan, who was able to present all of that testimony. It need not necessarily be a psychologist. It could be a social worker or somebody with some sort of training that would have led them to develop that information.
Mm-hmm. But his trial counsel hired a psychologist, and had an investigator. Are you suggesting that the minimum standard is people have to hire somebody referred to with the title as mitigation specialist?
That's what the ABA guidelines suggest.
Well, and I'm glad you brought that up. The ABA guidelines appear in your brief.
Yes, ma'am.
Throughout. You're not suggesting, though, that this is the governing standard of professional competence in capital cases, are you?
It is the standard that the Supreme Court has relied on to determine what is reasonable performance of counsel. Is it a mechanical checklist of what counsel must do? No, absolutely not under the case law. Although I personally would submit that it should be, but that's not the law.
But you know, in Penholster, the Supreme Court faulted the Ninth Circuit for reading their Williams and Wiggins opinions as establishing a constitutional duty to investigate in capital cases and emphasizing that, quote, beyond the general requirement of reasonableness, specific guidelines are not appropriate, end quote.
And I submit to you that a reasonable investigation under Wiggins would have resulted in at least trial counsel realizing that Mrs. Jennings was not a good mother.
Yeah.
If not all of the other mitigation that came in.
So on the good mother front, I mean, the penalty phase in this case was basically, I mean, I've seen transcripts like this, I mean, like hundreds of transcripts like this. We're at the penalty phase of trial, the mother testifies, the mother asks the jury, spare my son, who is a triple murderer, not really for his sake, but for my sake, right? I'm the mother, don't send my son to be executed. Isn't that a strategic choice that counsel could make and say, look, I don't want to have the mother testify about how bad of a mother she is, then she can't make that pitch.
The Supreme Court didn't think so in Sears. I think that was very much the issue in Sears. I think it was Sears, unless I'm misquoting, but one of the cases. The counsel's purported strategy decision was to put on evidence that this would affect the family. How bad would this execution or death sentence affect the family? And the Supreme Court said, unless you investigate and you determine what's available to you, you can't formulate a reasonable strategy.
But he, I mean, as Judge Branch said, I mean, he had a psychologist, he had an investigator, he did in fact talk to the mother, so he had personal, you know, I mean, he could sit down across the table from her and talk to her and see how much of a witness she would be. How is that not a sufficient investigation to at least get to the point where you say, you know what, this mother is a pretty sympathetic figure and I think we ought to put her on?
Well,
even if one could disagree with that, you know, 20 years later.
The problem, again, is he didn't investigate before arriving in that decision. And let me address the other part of your question.
But Mr. Callow, he did investigate. I mean, you're suggesting his investigation wasn't thorough enough. But this is not a case where defense counsel did nothing, right? He hired a couple of mental health experts to evaluate him. He talked to the mother. He asked Mr. Jennings about whether or not there was any abuse, sexual or otherwise, right, during childhood or stuff like that. So he did investigate. You're just saying that the investigation wasn't enough for Sixth Amendment purposes. But this is not, in my personal opinion, this is not a no investigation case.
It is marginally more than no investigation.
The mental health side, the expert that post-conviction counsel called agreed with the two mental health experts that were retained at the time of trial on a lot of the underlying facts, and they disagreed about diagnoses and terminology. And I think one of the experts, I forget which one it was, said that on at least one of the issues it was a matter of opinion. So, I mean, he hires two experts. They don't give him the information that he thinks he needs, which I think for him is he's looking for a home run, given that it was a triple murder, right? And he doesn't want to expose anything negative in those reports to the state if he's going to call them as witnesses. So he decides to go a different route.
Judge, I'll say, first of all, the issue of whether or not the experts' evaluations were sufficient, or that wasn't part of the COA, so as the state had pointed out. So I haven't gotten into that so much in my briefs, other than to suggest that their examination of his childhood and background was insufficient. But, you know, you're dealing with a death penalty case. This case had national coverage. I recall when it happened. You can't just go to the local guy or the local site, you know, the local expert that you always go to, and have them do a report without providing any sort of background information, without ensuring that they speak to collateral people. You can't send, bless Mr. Neary, he I'm sure is a competent investigator in some circumstances. He's not a mitigation investigator. You can't send him out to go and develop background information about childhood, and then expect your mental health experts to provide any sort of assistance to you in presenting mitigation when you haven't done the very basics of what needs to be done.
Why? When you have been working with these people, especially the investigator, for the any number of capital cases that they'd worked on together, why is that working relationship over the course of years not sufficient on capital cases, just because we now have a national profile case?
Neither one of those experts said anything about mitigation in this case. They had no records. They had no collateral interviews with family, with mother. They were completely, their work in this, I don't know them. Their work in this case was completely subpar. As a matter of fact, not even subpar. They didn't even have any comment about any mitigation in their reports, any statutory mitigation at least. And again, this is not your run-of-the-mill, okay, I think the client may be insane or incompetent. This is a developing mitigation case. You can't just go to your psychologist and your psychiatrist that you go to in all your other cases.
On all your other capital cases, right?
Well, I don't think that was the testimony. I mean, trial counsel testified that he had used these experts before, but I don't recall that it was specific to the capital cases. And frankly, trial counsel testified that he had 30 clients on death row and that they had all gotten off death row in one way or another. And I don't know that you can necessarily say that trial counsel...
You wouldn't put up a billboard that said, I'm a criminal defense lawyer with 30 clients on death row? You don't think that would be a good advertisement for a criminal defense lawyer?
It's certainly not self-serving, let's just say that. But more importantly, it goes to... I think trial counsel's approach to this case was, okay, I'm just going to treat this like any other case without appreciating this is a death penalty case with three murders, as the court...
What about that? I mean, we've talked about deficient performance, but what about prejudice? I mean, Judge Jordan raised this point. I mean, this was a triple homicide.
So was Sears.
I know.
And Wiggins was a multiple homicide
but
case.
But the level, and you're right, and the atrocity or heinousness of a crime doesn't allow counsel to not investigate, right? You've got to investigate to a degree that meets the Sixth Amendment standard. But the level of the crimes also requires a certain level of new mitigating evidence that could have been presented that would have had a chance to tilt the scales. And I'm not sure you've got that in this case. I mean, these weren't even three murders that were committed with a gun and a shot to the head where death would have been likely instantaneous. These were people who had their throats slashed. And they were two of the three of them were bound. So you need a heck of a lot, I think, of mitigating evidence, of new mitigating evidence to show that had it been introduced, there's a likelihood of the reasonable probability of a different outcome. Tell me how that calculus works for you.
I point to two things. First of all, recall that two jurors still recommended life, even with the paucity, the 34 pages of transcript of mitigation. So at least two jurors saw that there was enough mitigation there to overcome the death sentence. That being said, there's a wealth of evidence that we put on at the post-conviction hearing here. I mean, Dr. Sultan's testimony spoke to the incidents that I've already outlined, the squalor, the filth, the neglect.
What do you say about this? And this is just a sticking point I have, I guess, about this case. And when you compare it to Wiggins and some of these others, I mean, oftentimes in a case like this one, after good counsel gets involved and investigates for, you know, a decade, they find school records, they find hospital records, they find, you know, real kind of hard evidence of sexual abuse, physical abuse, depredation, stuff like that. Here, it really seems like the only thing that you have is hearsay evidence that an expert would say that some other person told the expert. Two questions. One, am I right about that, that that's where all this stuff comes in, is it sort of hearsay? And two, is that something that matters when we're thinking about prejudice?
If I can jump to the second part of your question first, it doesn't matter. Florida law is pretty clear that hearsay evidence, as long as it's reasonably rebuttable, is admissible at a penalty phase. And for good reason, because you're going to get a lot of family stories and family history and background information that's going to come in through third parties. Sears, again, speaks to this, in saying that Georgia's hearsay rules should not foreclose consideration of this mitigating evidence. I hope that that answers your question.
Well, and I guess, I think that might be the best answer, but just to press on it a little bit, I guess my point isn't sort of, is hearsay admissible or not? It's more, how do we weigh the import of that when the only basis for saying, for example, that the statutory rape occurred is that the defendant says the statutory rape occurred, and he says that to a psychologist. So we don't have the defendant saying it, which is not a particularly credible source anyway, and we have a hearsay reported through a psychologist. Would we weigh the prejudicial effect of that any differently than if there was a police report and a conviction based on statutory rape?
That's a question for the jury. We can speculate as to what the jury might have made of it, but
well, it's a question for prejudice, right? I guess that's my point. We're trying to predict what would happen if this had been introduced at the time, and one of the sticking points for me is just I have a hard time evaluating what a jury or a senator would say if this was being introduced not as a hard fact, here's the police report, here's the conviction, but introduced as the defendant told a psychologist who is now testifying about it. Maybe your answer is we just shouldn't care. That's fine if that's your answer. It doesn't matter.
Well, as a jurist, you certainly should care. But as a juror, how much difference would that make? This is an issue of admissibility more than it is an issue of credibility, I think.
Well, it's an issue of weight, right? And that's what we're doing. At this point, we're reweighing the aggravating and mitigating factors, and you would like to add to the mitigating part of the weight these things that allegedly occurred to him. And I guess my point is, in a case where there's a police report, in a case where there's school records, in a case where there's that kind of stuff, I can see the weight. Here is just, I'm having difficulty seeing, and maybe we should weigh it the same as school records, but I'm having a difficult time evaluating that because it's perfectly possible that the state's position would be not that these school records shouldn't outweigh the aggravating circumstances, but the state's position could be that this never even happened, that there's no reason to believe that he was statutorily raped when he was 12 years old, and there's just no reason to think it actually happened.
A jury, I suppose, could possibly have thought that. My concern as a lawyer is, does that diminish the mitigation in the eyes of the jury that Sears warns about, as Sears warns about? We're supposed to, the court is supposed to look at the newly presented evidence and weigh it and speculate as to what effect it would have had on the jury. Now, we're lawyers. I don't think anybody on Mr. Jennings' panel jury was a lawyer. They're not given an instruction that they should weigh this, at least not to my recollection. They weren't given any instruction about weighing hearsay evidence which is often done in guilt phase. And again, the rule specifically allows hearsay to be admitted for the reasons that I discussed.
Okay. Well, I think you've answered that to my satisfaction.
Okay, thank you.
And let me ask you one question about your criticism today of the methodology employed by Dr. Masterson, for example. that it's flawed, his evaluation, you're arguing, is incomplete. How is that error attributable in any way to counsel's performance?
Dr. Masterson, you know, he had no information whatsoever. I think he went and got his own records from the jail and from, you know, jail medical records and some school records. But they were very incomplete because they were only from the year or two prior. That is not doing an investigation and effectively using your experts. That's trial counsel's responsibility. And I think trial counsel even admitted on the stand that it's the trial lawyer's responsibility to provide that sort of information to the expert and not expect the expert to go and locally just get what's available there. More importantly, mom. You know, the state court was critical of mom for not showing up and cooperating. If you read Dr. Masterson's report, he talks specifically about how Mr. Jennings told him that his mother would like to come visit him and it would be a good idea for him to talk to the doctors, but she didn't have a ride. She was ill. She had cancer, leukemia. She relied on her boyfriend, and her boyfriend wanted her mom to have nothing to do with this case or her son. So here you have trial counsel who's well aware of this fact. He's got this report, and you've got the expert who's well aware of this fact, that mom cannot just get in the car and drive over to the doctor's office. And when she doesn't show up, trial counsel just gives up. Any reasonable lawyer would have either gone to mom, taken the doctor to mom, or call a cab. I mean, you know, you can't just say mom is at fault. So Dr. Masterson's report, it's lacking because trial counsel failed to provide a lot of the information that should have been provided.
On that score, the state courts found that although Dr. Eisenstein criticized Dr. Masterson and his report, Dr. Eisenstein indicated that Dr. Masterson alluded to a lot of the same issues in his report and that he used the correct test available at the time, and that it was, in essence, a difference of opinion as to what the diagnosis was. Doesn't that diminish, to use Judge Brasher's words, the weight of that testimony when we're supposed to be redoing a weighing of the new evidence against the old?
Judge, that goes specifically to the contemporaneous examination of Mr. Jennings, which, again, was not part of the COA. This was about examining his background and childhood development, but in answer,
I know, included in the question was the recognition by Dr. Eisenstein, that Dr. Masterson had used the correct test available to him, and if he did use the correct test available to him, why wasn't Mr. Osteen able to rely on his findings and his conclusion?
Because that only goes to the neuropsychological testing. That goes nothing to...
Of course, I understand that. But that goes into the whole... That is part of the decision as to which defense strategy to use at mitigation, right? At sentencing.
Honestly, Judge, I don't see how it does. It's a completely different inquiry. You're talking about...
No, but if you have... Dr. Wald, for example, reviewed his, I think it was Dr. Wald, but I could be mistaken about the expert's name. He reviewed some medical records from the jail and some school records, right?
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
And so you think that the investigation was obviously deficient and substandard, in your words, but it's not like those experts didn't have anything.
Judge, they didn't have anything from his childhood. They didn't have...
If they had school records, how could they not have something from his childhood?
They had school records from high school, and he didn't even complete high school.
You're saying most of the childhood. High school is childhood.
Fair enough. But they didn't have anything prior to when he moved to Fort Myers. the records that were important were the records that showed that he went to 14 different elementary schools, 14 by sixth grade. That's important. That's significant. They also, they didn't have any medical records. They had jail medical records, but they had no evidence of the febrile seizures. They had no evidence of the multiple concussions or head injuries that Mr. Jennings had. Again, all of these things are significant.
But also, you have Jennings self-reporting to Dr. Wald and Dr. Masterson that he had had a pretty normal and pretty good first 15 years, mm-hmm. and that his life took a negative turn after moving to Florida at 15. So in light of this information, why is it objectively unreasonable for counsel to focus his investigation on Jennings' life after his move to Florida, particularly because Jennings was 26 at the time of the murders?
I guess the best answer to that would be Judge Brasher's comment that, the defendant is not always the best self-reporter. And you can't expect somebody with limited education and situation that he was in to understand what mitigation is. We see this all the time where people are asked, were you sexually abused? And they say, no, of course not. Or were you physically abused? No, of course not. And then you find out what really happened to these people because you do what is required to be done. You go out and interview family and interview and obtain records. You can't just take the client's word for it, that they deny hallucinations, right? How do you know? It's completely unreasonable to just rely on the report of someone in that position and not go further.
Okay, Mr. Cowell, thank you very much. You've reserved your whole time for rebuttal.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, Mr. Buckwalter.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Rick Buckwalter, and I represent the respondents in this case, the Secretary for the Florida Department of Corrections and the Florida Attorney General. Mr. Jennings in this case was provided highly experienced trial counsel. Mr. Osteen, at the time that he began representation of Mr. Jennings in this case, had tried approximately 30 capital cases is what he estimated at the hearing. He was a senior assistant public defender for the Collier County office, for the public defender's office for the 20th Judicial Circuit of Florida. And he began working almost immediately on the penalty phase of this case, the beginning of his representation. On March 4th, he filed a motion for appointment of confidential experts, and he sought the appointment of a psychiatrist, Dr. Ward, who he had worked with on a regular basis, who knew what it was that trial counsel was looking for in his cases and what type of evaluation trial counsel sought. In addition, he then sought appointment of Dr. Masterson, the psychologist, to do the necessary testing as well. He met with the defendant, he met with the defendant's mother, spoke with both of them, and interviewed them. Based on that interview, he obtained the names of other friends or potential witnesses, interviewed them, and obtained from them names of further potential witnesses. So this is not a case where we can say that trial counsel did absolutely no investigation.
I agree with that, Mr. Buckwalter, but it seems pretty basic that in a case like this one, you would at least seek out school records, medical records, to see what there is before deciding on some sort of strategy. And it doesn't seem like that was done here.
Well, it's true that...
That might not lead to a finding of ineffectiveness, right? But, it's not the normal course, especially when you are... And again, this may help you on the prejudice prong, but when you're facing the death penalty for three gruesome murders, you better start looking. And you better look long and you better look hard. And getting medical records and school records is not that onerous a task. You get your client to sign a waiver of confidentiality for medical records, and you go and get records from the school system. And the two experts he hired didn't have all of those records, and that they missed some stuff. And anybody who's done any of this long enough knows that how you diagnose and evaluate is based in part on what records you have as context. Something that someone says or does or performs during a test may mean nothing in the abstract, but when viewed in light of something you've got in the background might either trigger a finding or require some additional work. So what do you say about the records in the case?
Well, there are two things I think we would respond to in regard to that. The first is, it's not, although trial counsel testified he did not provide the records to the doctors, we also need to bear in mind that at the time trial counsel testified, he had not had an opportunity to review his entire file. The transcript shows that at the time of the hearing, he had only opportunity to look over one of his files. In fact, opposing counsel actually didn't wish to call him at that time, but he had no other witnesses available to testify. So I don't know how much we can rely on trial counsel's memory with regard to the entire investigation.
Is there anything in the records of his files that indicates that he obtained these records or even looked for them?
We don't know. The files weren't introduced into evidence, and Mr. Osteen only had the opportunity, he said, to look over one of his files. We don't know if that's one file out of how many files, in fact. But I would say even more importantly, the court indicated that although there was...
Which court are you talking? We have a lot of courts. Are you talking about?
It was the Florida Supreme Court, I believe.
Okay, got it.
That stated that although there was testimony that they didn't have those records, there was no testimony but that what was contained in those records that would have made any difference in this case. So I think that even if this court were to find that that was a deficiency, there's really no evidence of any prejudice resulting from that deficiency.
There was no evidence presented as to what those records contained?
Not that would make a difference in the case, according to the Florida Supreme Court.
And what did those records indicate?
Well, we're not entirely certain about what those records indicated.
You litigated the case.
Correct.
So somebody has to know what those records showed, unless you're telling me that those records were not introduced either on their own or through the testimony of any mitigation expert.
I don't think those records were introduced.
So we have no, if you're telling me that if we go into this record and do a deep dive, we are not going to have any documentary evidence or oral testimony as to what the medical records and the school records showed.
I don't believe you will find any. Let me be clear on something. There were records that were proffered in the case. That there was an attempt to introduce the records into evidence. The state objected. These were records that those were records that were provided to the medical experts for review, post-conviction counsel's medical experts to review, and the state objected to them as hearsay, and the court in its discretion determined that they were hearsay and did not allow them.
Okay, but you know what they are.
I can't recall seeing anything in those records personally would have made any difference.
Can I ask you a question about, so to me, the only way that this case kind of matches up with Wiggins and other cases where there's a finding of prejudice after a state court said there was no ineffective assistance of counsel is with the statutory rape, with the living conditions with the mother. What do you say about that? One, you know, what about how that would get into evidence anyway. Is there any evidence that actually happened? And then two is, what about the prejudicial aspect of that?
I'm sorry, I missed one of the words you used. I kind of missed the context.
Well, it was a great word, whatever it was. Just go with it.
I think you said abrogated, but I'm not sure, and I want to make sure.
The question is just the statutory rape, the mother's, the living conditions with the mother, you know, the fact that she might have had intercourse in front of the defendant, et cetera. What do you do with that?
Well, when you say, what do I do with that?
What do you make of it?
What do you make of it? Why isn't it prejudicial? Could it even have been admitted anyway?
Because under Strickland, prejudice is a determination that if defense counsel was deficient in his representation, that deficiency leads to a reasonable probability that we would have a different sentence. And my response to your question is that that's not the case here. That even this additional, what we call limited mitigation that was presented at the evidentiary hearing isn't sufficient for this court to conclude that the state's decisions that there's not a reasonable probability of a different result is itself unreasonable, which is the standard that AEDPA places upon this court in its determinations.
Who testified about the statutory rape?
I'm sorry?
Who testified about the statutory rape?
The statutory rape, the testimony, you mean the evidentiary hearing?
Yes, or through documentary evidence presented before or after the hearing that the trial court allowed. How did that evidence get in to the post-conviction proceeding?
That evidence was in the report of either Dr. Wald or Dr. Masterson. It was self-reported by...
But Masterson was at the initial trial.
Correct.
Wald was... No. Wald was also at the
correct.
Initial trial?
Correct. Dr. Wald was the first doctor that Mr. Osteen sought appointed to the case, and Dr. Masterson was a psychologist. So those were both from the original case.
You think that incident was referenced in both reports?
I think it was only referenced in one that I can recall. I'm not sure which
one. And that was based on information provided by Mr. Jennings himself?
Correct.
Not from any other records that
not that
those
I can
doctors
recall.
Obtained?
Not that I, no. I believe they stated that Mr. Jennings informed them of that he was he was babysitting the child of a neighbor of his mother, and it was the mother of that child who I think Dr. Masterson described as seducing him at an early age. I need to make a correction to Judge Jordan, specifically your question earlier about the records. There were, I believe that in those records, they do talk about the head injuries, for instance. However, that was not something which trial counsel wasn't aware of. In other words, trial counsel was aware, as a result of the doctor's reports, that there were several incidents in which the defendant had suffered head injuries. And that was taken into consideration in their determinations and their evaluations.
Let me ask you this. I mean, so, you know, the way I understood it is the experts, the mental health experts at the initial trial had evidence about what I'm calling the statutory rape, which is what it was. You know, there was some evidence that, I mean, the lawyer knew about the head injuries. Why wasn't any of that presented to the jury? I mean, why? I mean, isn't this, I mean, it just seems like the best case for Mr. Jennings is that you have the situation where there's 30 some odd pages of penalty phase. There's some pretty good stuff to present to the jury here about head injuries and, you know, sort of weird sexual activity going on at this household, both with the mother and with this neighbor, and just none of it's presented.
There's two reasons. Mr. Osteen made a strategic decision that the presentation he was going to use in the penalty phase was to present good characteristics about Mr. Jennings rather than, you know, bad things that happened to him. So that was a strategic decision which both the post-conviction trial court and the Florida Supreme Court found to be reasonable strategic decisions. In fact, the district court found that as well. The second reason is, if he was going to introduce that type of testimony, that evidence actually, as far as we know, we don't know that anyone other than either was, whether it was Dr. Wald or Dr. Masterson, had knowledge of that from Mr. Jennings telling him about it. Well, that requires him then to call either Dr. Masterson or Dr. Wald as a witness, and that just opens up a whole total can of worms for the defendant. If you recall, one of the mitigating factors that the defendant was seeking in this case was that there were no prior crimes that he had been involved in. And his statements to the doctors just opens up that can of worms, talks about a whole history of criminal activity that the jury never was aware of, that they would have become aware of if that testimony was presented. We're talking about stealing, I believe he said, from 20 different employers. The fact that for a two-year period, he was not only using drugs heavily, but as he described it, dealing and transporting drugs. And then, of course, there was what was filed as the actual charge was an attempted robbery, in which Mr. Jennings told the doctor it was actually a kidnapping with an attempt to murder the individual, because that individual had threatened Mr. Jennings' fiance because she owed him drug money. So had he done that, he determined that that could have been, or he feared at least, that that would have been more harmful than helpful, and so he shied away from any of that type of testimony.
And also in the report, the other negative piece of information, I think both doctors, while they might not have diagnosed him with the explosive disorder, had indicated that there were sociopathic tendencies.
Absolutely, and thank you, Judge. I intended to mention that as well. There were some strong comments about the fact that he was on what the doctors call the 2-4 scale, in which he was showing sociopathic tendencies. And there's several statements about that. In fact, Dr. Wald mentions in his report that although, and he used the term lip service, although the defendant provided lip service, indicating that he kind of felt bad about what happened, the doctor didn't even believe him because of the prior statements he had made about the fact that, you know, all the crimes he had committed in his past, he really didn't feel guilty about. He had seemed to have no care one way or the other. Again, evidence that you wouldn't want the jury to hear if you're seeking to avoid a death sentence in the case. There was one other thing I wanted to mention, Judge Jordan, that based on your question about the records, I'm sorry, it slipped my mind.
Well, like, for example, Mr. Callil says that the school record showed that he moved 14 times among schools when he was very, very young. Do the records show that?
There are, yes. If you look at the school records, they give indications of schools. I have to admit, I don't know the number of schools.
Okay,
count
but a lot. He moved
but
the, a yeah, lot.
He clearly admitted that they moved several times. He moved in Oregon, he moved from Oregon, he moved back to Oregon. He moved because his mother was seeking employment. There was also a man she was involved with. So there was a lot of moves. I mean, you know, military brats grow up in, you know, fairly similar situations. I mean, maybe not that many moves. I don't know offhand. But it's not that unusual for people to move a lot, where it's the type of mitigation we would determine would result in the reasonable probability of a different sentence in this case.
Yeah, my question is not so much a prejudice question, but again, going back to the other question I asked, do the records show this stuff, or you're saying the records don't show this stuff?
And I have to Judge, they do, obviously, they show the movement that he did move. They're the medical records would indicate that he had the injuries. And I'd also recalled after I responded to you that there was also, I believe, records that showed that he had, I think they're called febrile convulsions when he was young. But of course, the other doctor who testified to that, I believe was Dr. Hyde, who was hired by post-conviction counsel, indicated that the only real importance of those records was that it provided the right for counsel to go ahead and get the testing done that was done. And that, of course, was done by trial counsel's experts as well. So there really would be no prejudice as far as that's concerned either.
Okay, so I'm sorry to ask it. I want to ask it one more time just because I want to know what to look for.
Okay.
You said before that someone tried to introduce the school records, but the state objected. The state trial court agreed with the state and excluded them on hearsay grounds. But now you've told me that at least some of the records were introduced and some of the records show something.
Yeah.
So I'm just trying to figure out, like, if I look at the record, what am I going to find with regard to the schools?
Yeah, I don't know if I believe the school records themselves were introduced. If not, there's testimony on it based on that regardless.
Okay.
So if you look in the record, you will see testimony about that at the very least.
Okay.
But just leave it at that.
Okay.
as I mentioned, trial counsel made two strategic decisions in this case. One was not to present the mental health mitigation, and that was because he feared that it would actually be more harmful than helpful because of the information that Mr. Jennings had provided to the doctors would then be available for cross-examination. Even though they were hired as confidential experts, if they're listed as witnesses, then the reports would have become discoverable at that time.
What did Dr. Eisenstein was one of the doctors hired by post-conviction counsel, right?
Correct.
Okay. Did his report indicate that there were some of the same red flags that you discussed with Judge Branch?
Same red.
The explosive disorder.
Oh, I'm sorry.
The sociopathic tendencies, things like that. Did they jive with the prior experts' reports in that regard or not?
I don't recall the report being introduced, but again, his testimony is in there along those lines. He came to some different conclusions than Dr. Masterson did. He was very critical, Dr. Masterson. However, in the end, the court determined that they basically came to the same conclusions. Not necessarily the same diagnoses. Dr. Eisenstein, for instance, diagnosed the defendant as having ADHD and called it a gifted learning disability. But overall, significant differences where, again, if in fact that testimony was presented to the sentencing judge or the jury, that we would consider there a reasonable probability of a different result in this case. And what we have in this case is highly aggravated facts. I mean, it's more than just a triple murder, and I certainly don't mean to say that, you know, a triple murder in itself is not bad enough. I mean, it was brutally done as well. I mean, we're talking about someone, three co-workers he worked with for almost a year. And the testimony was that he slit their throats. He nearly decapitated one of them. The testimony of the medical examiner was that the knife went so far through, he actually literally sawed through the vertebrae of the assistant manager. When I say saw, that's my term that I'm characterizing it at. That's what he said. He stated that there were three, I don't know the exact term, the blade cuts into the bone that he saw, and testify that in his opinion it would have taken more than three to get through that vertebrae. So it was just totally brutal, left him there in like, you know, to die in pools of blood. It's a horrific offense. The sentencing court found three separate aggravators in the case. The first was that it was committed during the commission of a robbery. The second was that the murder was committed so that basically for witness elimination. And the third is that it was cold, calculated, and premeditated, which the Florida Supreme Court has indicated is among the weightiest aggravators under Florida law. So this was a horrific crime. The limited mitigation in this case, we don't think changes the scales at all. And that there does not exist a reasonable probability of any different sentence in this case. If the court doesn't have any further questions, I'll go ahead and sum up.
Go right ahead.
Based on the argument today and the argument made in the brief, the state of Florida respectfully requests that this honorable court affirm the decision of the district court denying the petition for habeas corpus. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Buchwalter. Mr. Callow, you've got your full 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Judge. I hope I can clear up some of the issue with the records and the medical, the school records and medical records. We did seek to admit them at the evidentiary hearing. The judge denied that on the grounds that they were not, the state had argued that they were not authenticated. Without even requesting that they be proffered, the judge offered to proffer them in the record, so they should be in the record as a proffered exhibit.
Okay.
But they were testified to at length by Dr. Eisenstein and by Dr. Sultan, who explained what is in those records and the significance of them. The big one was this idea that Brandy Jennings was a straight-A student his entire life until he moved to Florida is ridiculous. He was nowhere close. And to the extent that there are records, they're limited, but they show that he is certainly not a straight-A student. And again, that was based on trial counsel's just listening to his mother saying what a great boy he was without having any sense of wanting to investigate further there.
Listening to his mother and to Jennings, correct?
I don't want to misspeak, but I don't recall Mr. Jennings ever saying that he was a straight-A student. And again, if that were the case, what reasonable trial attorney would just say, okay, my client says he's a straight-A student, and that's why he's sitting in the jail accused of three gruesome murders? I mean, that to me just doesn't seem very, very reasonable. I want to also emphasize, you know, the state talks a lot about Masterson and Wald and whether or not trial counsel should have called them. You know, I don't believe I ever made the argument that trial counsel should have called Mr. Wald or Dr. Wald or Dr. Masterson. I haven't made that argument, and I wouldn't make that argument based on those reports either. The problem with them is that they didn't perform even a rudimentary examination to determine mitigation. For the reasons that I've spoken to before, and they're outlined in the brief, they did no background investigation other than getting the most contemporaneous records. They never spoke to any family, any friends. One of them might have spoken to a contemporaneous friend, but no family, nobody that knew Mr. Jennings growing up, and they were completely unaware of all of the things that the records and the family members had to say about the background.
So I'd like to go back to my question.
Sure.
So in my notes, I have that Dr. Eisenstein noted that although both Jennings and his mother indicated that Jennings was a straight-A student. So you're saying that the fact that His mother reported that, and he reported that, that also should have been taken as potentially not true and investigated further.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Just as I wouldn't have taken it as one of the other judges pointed out, excuse me for not recalling which, it's not difficult. In this case, it was a little bit more difficult than it usually is because there were 14 schools, but it's not that difficult to get school records. You know, we did it. Limited, admittedly, but we did it. And it didn't take 10 years. It took, you know, a matter of a month or two. I just want to also address regarding the trial attorney files and trial counsel not having an opportunity to review them. I don't want to go too far outside the record, but I will say that trial counsel did review those records before he testified at the hearing. He had provided those records to us and didn't retain a copy of them. So he was afforded that opportunity. But more importantly, the state reviewed those records, trial counsel's records. The assistant attorney general came to my office and reviewed those records for hours. And as I recall, she brought her daughter with her. Again, I don't want to get outside the record, but as an officer of the court, I can submit that the state reviewed those records at length. And if there was anything in there that supported the state's position, Carol Dittmar was the AG at the time, she would have brought it to the court's attention. And to trial counsel's attention before he testified. Again, I'm not arguing that anybody or that trial counsel should have called Dr. Walder, Dr. Masterson, but to the extent that they had negative things to say, of course they had negative things to say. They always do when you have a client who's accused of killing three people. They never made a diagnosis of an antisocial personality disorder. They never made specific diagnoses at all, to my recollection, about a personality disorder. There was a sort of a vague allusion to sociopathic tendencies. There was they did do an MMPI, which showed that there was some inclination towards sociopathic tendencies. But I don't recall seeing anything about it, any diagnoses.
Well, also, I would note, we are in 1995 when we're talking about when the murders were committed. And certainly, you know, and I'm not up on the DSM and what it meant, what it said back in 1995, while being a sociopath was certainly in that. I don't know at what point in time antisocial disorder came into the fray. So are you holding the trial counsel's experts to a higher standard that exists now as psychology has evolved?
I don't believe so. I think that the standard at the time would have been if they felt that he had a personality disorder, they would have said so in the report. However, conceitedly, these reports don't say much about a diagnosis. They just make these sort of...
And you think that sociopathy is not a personality disorder?
Well, it's certainly not recognized as a personality disorder in the DSM, and not in the one that was in effect at the time of the trial. I believe it was the DSM-3 at the time. Sociopathy is it's a clinical term, but it's not a diagnosis. But again, all of that's sort of a red herring because the argument is not that they should have called Dr. Walder, Dr. Masterson. I mean, if they had great things to offer, I would have put them on. But they just didn't do the kind of work that needs to be done in these kind of cases. I also just wanted to address the state's contention that trial counsel started working immediately on the case. That may be true. And that trial counsel met with the defendant's mother. Trial counsel testified that he spoke to the mother maybe three times, maybe on the phone and maybe in his office. He didn't have specific recollections. I don't believe there were any notes from any of that that were available. Again, I submit that is not a reasonable investigation. To call, Mom is local. He didn't have to fly to Oregon. He could have gone to see her in her home. He could have, he and Mr. Neary could have gone. Mr. Neary could have gone by himself. Dr. Wald or Dr. Masterson could have gone. To call Mom up and say, tell me good things about your son, is not a reasonable investigation, and I don't think any reasonable jurist could say so. I'm approaching the end, so unless there are any other questions, I will ask that the court reverse the district court's opinion denying habeas corpus relief.
All right, thank you very much, Mr. Cowell.
Thank you.
Thank you again, Mr. Bookwalter. We'll take the case under advisement, and we're in recess for today. Thank you.
Thank you.